Okay, well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Construction Law Committee monthly conference call. This is Scott Hardy Roberts. Our chair was not able to make it today, and he's asked that I go ahead and run the meeting. Couple of items to report on. Reese Anderson is now our co-vice chair. So welcome, Reese, and then
Thank you, Scott.
Sure. And then Brian Judah is going to be taking over as our new membership chair. So thank you, Brian, for that. I suspect doing a lot of the heavy lifting up until now, so now you'll get the credit for that as well.
You're very welcome.
And with that, that's all I have to report on. So before we get into the committee reports, I think the minutes from our last meeting were circulated, and if we get a motion to approve those.
So moved.
And then if anybody, unless anybody has any objections, we'll go ahead and approve those as distributed. And with that, we'll jump right to the committee reports. Now, I know that in the agenda it said no report for the ABA forum liaison, but I think Quintero, I think, Jason, are you on the line?
I am.
Okay, do you want to give your report?
Not too much of a report, but I wanted to give everybody a heads up on some events for the ABA construction law. The construction forum meeting is going to be in Austin, Texas. The focus is going to be on ADR. That meeting will be taking place for 8th and 9th. I believe the block at the Hilton is already sold out, but there's plenty of accommodations close by. So if you haven't made plans to attend, please sign up and come on out. We'd love to have you. Upcoming meetings for the ABA, we've got our midwinter meeting this year will be in San Francisco. That will take place January 21st and 22nd. And then our next annual meeting is April 28th through 30th, and that's going to be in Nashville.
All right. Thank you, Jason.
No problem.
Next committee is ADR. Deb Mastin, are you on the line?
I am. We are sneaking up on our directory and look for it in your email any day now.
Great. Thank you, Deb. Fred, I know you're on the line. Do you want to give your report on the certification exam?
I'm real excited to tell you that we, of the 54 applications from last year, 45 people took the exam this past March. 23 of them passed, which brings us to a total of 360 board-certified construction lawyers. For those of you interested, October 31st is the deadline, so you have a couple of months. You have to have your 45 hours in construction law by the date of your application. And I was about to read the names of the 53 members who are board certified in construction law. And one of them, David Manassi, just walked in the room. But Chad Averro, Frederick Barnes, Miguel Brazuli, I believe, Roger Brown, Monica Cardias, or I guess it's Cardenza, Angela Covington, Stephen Gross, John Hanbrick, Patrick Howell, Dara Jabrock, Kevin Kelly, Circuit Judge Mark Kaiser, Terrence Lavey, Spencer Mallard, Scott Mason, Leo, I believe it's Mira Rose, Dave Manassi, Joseph Passeretta, Carl Pearson, Scott Pence. Hey.
Congratulations.
Read that one again.
Two more. Evan Small and Michael St. Jacques, the second, I believe. I hope I didn't butcher those too badly, but welcome.
Thank you, Fred. All right. With that, we're going to move on to the certification review course. I know, Deb, you're on the line. I don't know if you're Report or Brian?
Report is all our speakers are confirmed. They're all board-certified construction lawyers. We're looking forward to a really good program. It's the same structure as last year, 2.5 days while you guys are playing golf. My people are going to be studying. It starts right after lunch on Thursday, goes all day Friday, and for the better part of Saturday. It ends mid-afternoon Saturday.
Excellent.
So if you need CLE, there's like 20 hours, 21 hours of CLE.
Great. No, that's great. Reese, did you want to give the report on the Construction Law Institute?
Yes, just briefly. We basically have our program put together as well. We're finalizing confirmation of speakers, and we have a very exciting luncheon speaker that Deb helped us lined up, who's going to talk about the impact of 3D printing on construction. Apparently, they are printing buildings in China as we speak. So our speaker is going to address that topic. So anyway, we're really excited about the program, and we'll of course have more details as we get closer to the event.
Thank you, Reese, and that does sound real exciting. Something's come up with Neil, and I don't think he was able to make the call, so we're going to skip the construction litigation report. Construction regulation, I know that Hardy had circulated the report that Fred put together for this month, Fred and Steve Sellers, and so I'll hand it back over to you, Fred.
Or Steve. This is Steve. I have two cases to report on. One of them is from the 11th Circuit, and it's applying Alabama law, but I thought it was interesting for its analysis, and also interesting because I have a case that's just like this right now. But there was a roofer that re-roofed a church, and in the process of doing that, he damaged the underlying roof deck. The roof deck was not part of his work, and that ended up leading to water infiltration as well. The insurance company defended him on a breach of contract lawsuit, and after an adverse judgment for about $350,000, I think it was, brought a deck action to have a declaration that they didn't have to cover the judgment. And the court said, no, you do have to cover it. And the issue was that the damage that was caused just under a plain reading of the insurance policy was not the workmanship, not the roof itself that was installed under contract, but damage to essentially other property, that being the roof deck and water infiltration to the plaster. It was two things were interesting to me. One is it was a breach of contract. And secondly, it was interesting that in order to replace the roof deck, they had to remove the roof. So they ended up getting a new roof as part of their cover damages. Second case, this is the case where the a trial judge had declared the Florida workers' comp law unconstitutional, facially unconstitutional, in the part where it has immunity for from a tort suit. The appellate court didn't take much time to overturn that, but what's interesting is they didn't do it based on the merits of the case. They did it based on mootness. They basically had the wrong parties involved in the case at that time. There's been several other cases that have come out in the last month, but not cases that I reported. We'll save those for the convention. Fred?
And I just have a few things to report on agency regulation. One is the continuing consideration by the Construction Industry Licensing Board on their regarding work experience, where they're trying to write in the words habitable and the word new. I think they're on dangerous ground, but they're going to take that up again this coming Friday at their board meeting in St. Petersburg. And you can expect to see, if they make any changes, you can expect to see some legal proceedings as a result. There's also a rules workshop this coming Wednesday at 10:30 or 10 o'clock. It's actually, I said 10:30 in the report. It's actually 10 o'clock, dealing with the issue of air conditioning contractors installing pool heaters, which they did for a number of years until the 2012 DEC statement, where the board ruled or issued a statement that only pool contractors can install pool heaters. I've asked them to reconsider that, and I believe unless they're willing to back off of their 2012 statement, that we'll see some interesting litigation over that one as well. The real point here I wanted to make is you will see that they have already disposed, and this report covers a two-month period, and they meet monthly. They've already disposed of 9 petitions for deck statement, most of which they refused to answer because they were defective in some way. In fact, I think they only answered 1 or 2 of those 9, but I've listed those on pages 2 and 3, and they've already received an additional 6, including 3 that they will hear this Friday in St. Pete. And that's CI, triple I, and C. And other than that, just to point out to you that there's a lot happening on the Building Commission front, one of which is a pending petition for deck statement that I have filed regarding window replacement. That was heard by the Energy Technical Advisory Committee last Wednesday, who ran out of time, and we expect they'll be taking it up again soon. Lastly, just mention to you, so you know, there's a legislative session that begins today. I think the Senate convenes at 3 o'clock. This is special session, C as in Charlie. It's to take up the Supreme Court's unconstitutional finding of the congressional redistricting plan from, gosh, it's 3 or 4 years old now, but they found, I think, up to 5 of the congressional districts were apportioned unconstitutionally in violation of the state constitution, which has a relatively new provisions in it. And so they'll be taking up that issue for the next, I think it's a 12-day session. So over the next 2 weeks. It's not likely that they will take up bills outside of that particular issue, but it's possible, and we'll continue to monitor and let our legislative committee know if anything comes up that we need to be aware of. That's it.
All right. Well, thank you, Fred, and thank you, Steve, both of you, for what is always a very informative and very thorough update on what's going on. Clara Margaret, are you on the line?
I am. Okay. I don't have a formal report this month, but there has been some discussion about involving the CLC and particularly our subcommittee in commenting on the American Institute of Architects' cyclical revisions to their standard form agreements. And this is something that we do at the ABA Forum on Construction Law level. I chair Division 12, which is Owners and Project Finance. And literally since, it's been several years ago that we were first invited to make comments from the owner's side. You know, this is a, it's not really an open,
God,
everybody.
These earplugs hurt like shit. Is there any other earplugs?
Excuse me.
I think we've got somebody. I'm sorry, Claire Margaret. I think we've got somebody who's talking who's not. If you're not giving a report, if you wouldn't mind putting your line on mute, and then that way we won't get interrupted. Thanks, Claire Margaret. Sorry about that.
No problem. But the point about the input is that we're looking into an arrangement with the AIA so that our subcommittee and any others who are interested can follow their, you know, protocol to keep things confidential. It's not like we get copies of the proposed revisions and then we can, you know, broadcast those proposed changes just to anybody. The AIA has a pretty confidential process, but once that's accomplished, then we can give our comments. We're looking into whether that would be individually making comments or whether we could comment on it as a subcommittee. There would be some approvals at our local Florida bar level in order to accomplish that. But that's something that we're looking into so our membership can have some commenting opportunities on their revisions, which, of course, occur about every 10 years. There are a couple of documents that are that are a 10-year cycle, but they're just not from the 2007-2017, like the A201 and the others, the major documents. So anyway, just wanted to kind of tip everybody off to that. If you're interested in making comments to those form agreements, please shoot me an email at cgroover@bplegal.com. That's it.
Okay, thanks, Claire and Margaret. And I guess we'll have to just stay tuned and see if there's a way that we're going to be able to weigh in on a committee level, like from the CLC mm-hmm. level, as opposed to just an individual level.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. I know that Carrie's not on the line, but Lee, or if you're on the line, do you want to give a report on the Contractors University?
Yeah, really no update from last month. We're still set. September 22nd is the first one in Fort Lauderdale, November date in Tampa, and then a spring 2016 date in Orlando. And we've started the marketing for the Fort Lauderdale presentation, and the RSVPs for attendees are coming in, and already it looks like we're going to have a pretty decent crowd. So far, so good. That's it.
Great. Thanks, Lee. I'll give a quick report on the legislative subcommittee. You may recall in previous months I reported that the Real Problems Study Committee of the Reptile Section was proposing some legislation that would modify the priority of lien statute under the lien law statute when the work had stopped. Right now, the way that the law is set up is that the work has to stop and everybody has to be paid in full or pro rata, and then the work can start back up and based on how the recordings of the new notice of commencement and things like that get recorded, you reprioritize the lienor's rights, the date that they would relate their liens would relate back to. They have since backed off of that position, which was a pretty comprehensive approach by the time we got to the end of it, and have since really proposed a much more streamlined proposition, which would only affect the notice of termination language within the lien law. I have not yet distributed that to our legislative subcommittee because there was at least one inadvertent mistake or takeaway from the current language, which when I talked to Alan and Lee about that, we all agreed that was an inadvertent oversight. And so we're trying to get that corrected. And once we get that corrected, it'll go out to the subcommittee. And then once we've weighed in on it, if we can get consensus on it, we'll report back to the full CLC for a vote on that, hopefully by next month. And so that's my report on that. Lee, I don't know if you want to go ahead, if now is the best time for you to talk about the open permit issue, or if you want to wait until the end of the reports, but either way, I'll leave that to your discretion.
Let's do it as part of legislative, because that's what it's going to end up being. And there is another legislative initiative that the reptile section is looking at that's going to impact us. So I'm going to briefly describe it here, and anybody who wants to have some say in shaping this committee's response to it, let Scott know that you want to join the legislative subcommittee, because I think that's probably the level that we're going to continue to pursue this at, to keep things nimble and flexible. But it's an open permit issue, and it's brought to us by a number of real estate attorneys through the section who are having problems doing sale closings on both residential and commercial properties where the permits had not been properly closed out. Final inspections had not been called for, and in most instances, the contractors disappeared. And they start getting into closings, and the open permits become a negligence issue for the lawyers who are doing closings without doing something to close out those permits. And expired permits don't answer it. They need to be properly closed, and the question is, what do we do about it? So from construction, this isn't really a problem. From real estate closings, it's apparently a big problem. And so the section has picked up at this stage just kind of a investigation into whether anything should be done about it, and if so, what. And the two general procedures that are being considered as possible statutory changes are as follows. The first one would be establish a period of years. My gut tells me it'll probably approximate a statute of limitations period of years, where if the permit is not closed out properly in that time period, it'll just be deemed closed. This would be done statutorily, so if it passed, it will just be the law and the building officials have to accept it. So that's option one, is just put an outside date after which the permits are just closed. Option two, which is really my preference, because what I don't want to do is close out electrical permits without final inspections and create issues in there. And if there's a fire, not only is there a life safety issue, but there's also probably a lack of insurance for not having gotten final inspections. So I like option two personally, and option two would be, if you can't find the contractor to close it out and do the final inspection, the owner who's selling the property can hire whoever they want to hire to go out there, see it, and submit a letter to the building department certifying, you know, that they did a final inspection, they looked at the design, whatever it might be, and it all meets with the permit requirements, and therefore the building official can just close out the permit that way. There may be other options. The various real estate related committees of reptile are starting to explore these in depth. Maybe there'll be legislation will come out of it. Maybe they'll say, we're going to just deal with it and not do anything. No one knows yet. But construction law obviously has been one of the committees that has identified as being invited to weigh in on this. So that is what's going to be coming down the pike over the next 2 to 3 months. And I reiterate, if anyone has an interest in participating in what this committee's response will be to that problem, let Scott Pence know that you want to join the legislative committee, because that's the level where this will be addressed.
Great. Thank you, Lee. And I'll just reiterate that if anybody is interested, whether it's for this particular issue or any other issue, if you're interested in becoming a part of the legislative subcommittee.
Hey, Lee, this is Fred. I don't have a dog in this fight, but I can understand why a purchaser would want all open permits closed out, because they might then be assuming the liability to fix anything that's wrong. But how is this a title issue?
It's not a title issue.
Okay.
It's more of a Johnson versus Davis type of an issue, where there is a known condition that affects the habitability of the premise. And I'm told, this is not my area of practice, but I'm told that there is law that would support a negligence violation for a closing attorney to not detect this and disclose it. And I guess also for his or her client. But it's not pure title.
I don't know of any case law on that, but I think it's better to be safe than sorry.
Yeah. And like I said, they're just exploring right now, and if all the various committees say, screw it, it's worth it, it'll die a natural death. But this committee is one of the ones that are asked to opine.
Lou, this is Barry. Quick question. Is BOAF or DBPR weighing in terms of the building officials and administrators' own obligations to actually follow up on their own permits?
Yeah, they've made comments about it. There's the procedures that the various building departments use from jurisdiction to jurisdiction just completely cover the waterfront. I mean, there's no uniformity whatsoever. We don't have a feeling for what the building officials are obviously going to say about it yet. We first wanted to see if this was even something Reptile is going to pursue. And then, of course, we'll have to fold them in. But we started with a bit of a survey. And I say we, by the way, because I just now got appointed as chair of this task force. Someone else had been chair before, but they started with a survey of the various building departments to see, what the building officials had to say. And like I said, there was no consistent theme that came out of it at all.
Right. And actually, I'll add to that. I think when we first started talking about this, Lee, about a year ago, one of the things somebody did bring up the fact that, the DBPR can fine a contractor for not closing out a permit. And I think the issue was, there were two issues. One is, if the contractor is no longer around, how do you find them? And two, the bigger issue was that the DBPR is so busy that they're not going to be actively pursuing these types of issues, and that really the only time that they would come up is if somebody were to report, the fact that there were open permits, and it, unless it was a life safety issue, would it even rise to the level of of them taking action on it.
That's correct. And to add to that as well, if someone did report and it did make it on their radar screen, it has to go through the whole administrative process, which is not nearly fast enough for these closings that they want to do.
I guess my question is more directed, is one of the areas to explore is should a building official administrator have an affirmative duty to follow up on open permits as the license, you know, as the agent issuing the permits, and maybe they already do, and it just falls into the waste bin of, you know, if there's no complaint, they don't do it. Rather than regulating the contractors, I understand the contractors out of the scene under the scenario, but it seems like since we've begun licensing building officials, that should fall under a licensure obligation they have.
Yeah, and it could. And you're 100% right about that, Barry. But the task force response to that was, that's not our issue. You know, accountability has a role to play in this. Because, for instance, if we go through option two that I mentioned, where the owner could just hire someone else to close it out, that comes at a cost. And how do you get that cost back? Well, ideally, you're going to go back after the license holder who should have done this in the first place. Or as you're saying, Barry, there could theoretically be some responsibility from the building official as well. But that's kind of a tangential issue, because what the task force is saying is it still doesn't help us get the immediate closeout of this permit that we need to be able to do a closing. So it doesn't matter who's responsible and who we could file license complaints against. You know, that takes, you know, 6 months or a year. I need to close this thing in 2 weeks. You know, so they're tangential issues, but it doesn't address what this task force is really trying to focus on.
And just for your information, they most certainly do prosecute for failure to close out permits, because that's usually an indication of an abandonment.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. All right. Well, stay tuned on that one. Moving on, we'll go to the membership subcommittee, our new subcommittee leader, Brian Judah.
Well, the official decision came out somewhat of a surprise to me today. I didn't know that the decision had been finalized. But with that said, I don't have any report for this month's meeting.
Okay, that's fine. Jared Smith, are you on the line? Do you want to talk about the newsletter?
Sure, just real quick. To all of our subcommittee heads, make sure our next newsletter is coming out in September. So please send me, if you've got anything you want included in there, date, time, meeting, anything like that, just shoot me an email, jsmith@rumberger.com, and we'll make sure to include that. Articles, another plug for that. This is a great opportunity to get before 600 of your peers. And this month's article is going to have an article in there from Sanjay about the changes in 558, which I've seen the article. It's a great article. So, you know, those are, you know, just practical stuff. It doesn't have to be long and meaty like a Florida Bar publication, and it can be, you know, something recent that came out, something that you've you know, dipped your hands into, and other people would be interested in. So just shoot it over to us. Last comment I would make is for distribution, and Scott, I'll just probably remind you of this when I send this out. The last time we sent out our email newsletter, there was a guy I was speaking to that is a member of the Construction Law Committee, and I asked him, you know, if he had read the newsletter, and he said, "Oh, we have a newsletter now." So I wonder if people kind of saw it as an attachment to the monthly CLC meeting, and they just thought it was an attachment, and they didn't go through all of them. Maybe thought it was the minutes or something like that. So we might want to send it out as a separate email. Just to make sure people are actually realizing that it's a separate deal. You know, it's our quarterly newsletter. So that's it.
Sure. No, and I think that's a great idea, Brian or Jared. And I'll just reiterate. I mean, I think that the newsletter is a great publication, a great service to our Construction Law Committee, and it's a great way for anybody within the committee, young or old, you know, to get kind of some recognition, some, you know, fairly simple recognition, because it doesn't have to be, you know, like a law review type of article. Can be a 500 word or just a little blurb or whatever about a recent case or any other kind of construction law issue that's kind of a hot topic. So thanks again for taking the lead on that, Jared. And I think we're looking forward to the next one coming out in September. the Publication Subcommittee. Sean Buckley, are you on the line?
I am, Scott. Thank you very much. And dovetailing off what Jared said, I know everybody is interested in getting themselves published and getting themselves out there for purposes of peer recognition or something to that effect. But if somebody has an idea that they want to get published in a newsletter, but they want to put a little bit more meat on the bone, the Publication Subcommittee is for you, because we'll get you published in Action Line or Florida Bar Journal. Because at this time, we don't have anything currently in the pipeline to get published or peer-reviewed. So if anybody has those ideas that they're willing to submit to a newsletter and they want to put a little bit more meat on that bone, send it my direction, and maybe we can toss around some ideas on how to beef it up a little bit. But at this point, nothing else in the pipeline, but always looking.
Okay. Thank you, Sean. And I think that's going to conclude our reports, because as I understand it, there's no report from the Small Business Programs this month from Lisa Colon-Heron. The Website Subcommittee, Brent Zimmerman, I understand there's no report. And then the Tech Subcommittee, Hardy's not able to make the call, and he said he had no report. So with that, I think what I'll do is hand it over to Angela Covington, who's our the chair of our CLE Subcommittee. And Angela, I'll let you introduce our speaker. Anything
okay,
else that you feel you need to talk about for CLEs?
Okay. All right. Just a couple of things before I introduce our speaker. I do have 5 new course numbers for the last 5 sessions we've had, and I'll get those to Hardy, and I'm sure he'll circulate those in the next day or two. And also, like always, if you all have any ideas about a person you'd like to hear from or a topic you'd like to learn more about, please just send me an email. It doesn't have to be anything elaborate. Just a one-liner is fine. My email address is acovington@com, and I would love to have your ideas. Today we have Laura Stefanovic, who will be speaking to us about federal rules and what the term possession, custody, or control has come to mean in the age of e-discovery. Laura is an attorney in the D.C. office of Smith, Curry & Hancock, where she practices in the areas of construction litigation and contract law. Laura has managed complex construction matters in litigation, in alternative forms of dispute resolution, and at the transactional level. She's written numerous articles and presented seminars throughout the United States on dispute prevention and resolution, with a particular focus on issues impacting the construction industry. Laura graduated from the universities of, I think, Kentucky and Virginia. She's been recognized as Georgia Super Lawyers Rising Star in 2013, and also in 2013 won for writing Article of the Year in the Journal of Legal Affairs and Dispute Resolution in Engineering and Construction. So we are lucky to have her speaking today, as I said, about possession, custody, or control. And Laura, if you're there, I'll go ahead and pass it on to you. Thanks for being here today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me and for that lovely intro. I will try to live up to it.
Laura, this is Scott. Before you get started, do you mind? I'd like to go ahead and put everybody on mute, and then put it back over to you so that if anybody puts us on hold or if there's any noise in the background, it won't interrupt your presentation.
Sounds good.
And then if you can, when you're done, just let me know when you're done, and I'll take everybody off mute, and we can open it up for questions if there's time.
Sounds good.
Conference is now in silent mode.
Well, good morning, everyone. Actually, it looks like we're now afternoon. I am here today to talk about the federal rules, 34 and 45, and what is meant by possession, custody, or control in the age of e-discovery. Today we're going to cover some of the jurisdictional conflicts on this issue, of which there are many, as no one will probably be surprised to hear. A lot of the information that I'm covering today can be found in the Sedona Conference's commentary on Rule 34 and Rule 45, which was published in April 2015. I would highly encourage you all to take a look at that, as this is an issue that we see more and more coming up, especially in the context of parties seeking sanctions under motions to compel, and invoking various failures on either the council's part or opposing parties' part to maintain documents, provide documents, and also to preserve documents within the context of the federal rules. As I dig into this, I think that you're going to see there is a shocking lack of clarity. Some jurisdictions are more draconian than others, but it is certainly riddled with pitfalls for the unwary. So with that said, I'll begin by sort of summarizing Rule 26 for everyone, which allows for the discovery of documents, electronically stored information, and tangible things in the responding party's possession, custody, or control. And Rule 34 and Rule 45 both obligate parties responding to document requests or subpoenas to produce documents, electronically stored information, and tangible things in parties' possession, custody, or control as well. The problem is the federal rules are silent on what is intended by the phrase possession, custody, or control, and that forms the primary focus today. Case law across circuits is really inconsistent about what is meant by that term, and there's a lot of opinions out there, some of them contradicting the own court in some cases interpretation. It's kind of a moving target. So knowledge of a particular jurisdiction's interpretation is going to be critical because parties are responsible for preserving and producing information and face material consequences for their failure to do so. And I was actually surprised in going through a lot of these cases the extent to which the courts are going to expect parties to really go above and beyond, in my opinion, to provide this evidence that's requested, even if it is not necessarily right within arm's reach. So, you know, why does it matter? I mean, obviously, when you're preparing for discovery, you want to be aware up front of what the court is going to expect you to do and your client to do. When you're putting together litigation hold letters, which everyone should do, I know not everyone is great about doing it, and sometimes it's easy to kind of let that requirement fall through the cracks, but after listening to me today, I think everyone will understand why these become even more important, not only to put your client on notice of what their obligations are going to be and what they are not allowed to do under the law with regard to their existing documents, but also as proof that, you know, in the event that it comes up in a context of a motion for sanctions, that you, as the attorney, did everything that you could to make sure that these protocols are being followed and that documents were being preserved, obtained, et cetera. We've seen cases recently where law firms have been sanctioned because their clients have destroyed evidence or inadvertently sometimes. But a well-timed litigation hold letter and one that was very broad in scope could have helped a lot with those attorneys, at least proving that they did meet their obligations. Now, another reason that you'll want to have kind of a roadmap planned out is, as you'll see, occasionally you're going to have to make some overtures with third parties to obtain information. I'll explain how that comes into play a little more, but suffice to say you cannot just look within the building for your documents anymore, especially in the age of the internet where a lot of these documents are hosted on remote servers. With regard to email, you may be using multiple email addresses even within the same company, and all of that kind of necessitates the participation and involvement of third parties. You're also going to have to think through how to obtain documentation or make contact with former employees, which I'm sure we've all had to coordinate with former employees in the context of depositions and testimony, but it's becoming even more clear that the courts are going to expect you to take affirmative steps to obtain documentation, up to and including emails that former employees sent or maintained. There's a lot out there in the world of social media and also the electronic environment, as I like to call it. This includes listservs, texts, private emails, blogs, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google, Twitter, avo.com. There's myriad locations where parties are posting information, maintaining information. As this expands, your scope of production expands as well. You're not just producing paper. You're not just producing emails. You may be producing additional information that is located far and wide. And so as part of your pre-litigation or litigation plan, you should be aware of where your client is maintaining their documents, what kind of online presence do they have, and just thinking through kind of how that's going to affect any future productions. The relationship between a party and the individual or entity that actually possesses the documents, as I previously stated, may not be the same. So what are your obligations to obtain documents from third parties? You know, is a subsidiary required to obtain documents from a parent corporation? What are your obligations where the parent is located in a foreign jurisdiction, possibly even, you know, another country? And what is the interplay between conflicting interests, statutes, laws, etc.? All of these are considerations that will be in some ways specific to whatever jurisdiction you find yourselves in, because some of the cases, as I've said, display a more draconian approach than those in others. And I have gone through cases from quite a few of these jurisdictions and kind of tried to parse through what their approach has been. The prevailing standards are as follows. There's a group of cases that use what is commonly referred to as the legal right standard, which is when a party has the legal right to obtain the documents in ESI, then it's within their custody and control, and they have an obligation to produce. The next is the legal right plus notification standard, which states that when a party has the legal right to obtain the documents, and if they do not have that legal right, that they have been requested by their adversary but to produce documents that they have made third parties aware that those documents have been requested, and also notify their opposing counsel identifying those third parties and the documents in their possession so that that adversary can take steps to obtain those documents via third-party discovery. And then lastly, we have the practical ability standard, and what that states is that when a party does not have the legal right to obtain the documents but has the practical ability to do so, then they have the obligation. That's the most complicated and difficult to apply standard, as I'm sure you can imagine, because, quote, practical ability has not really been defined. So we're including a vague term on top of a vague standard, which makes this even more complicated. The legal right standard, which is the most straightforward, just requires a party to preserve, collect, search, and produce documents in ESI, which the party has a legal right to obtain. This is figured out on a case-by-case basis, as I'm sure you can imagine. The legal right plus notification standard similarly requires that, but also requires that the party notify its adversary about potential relevant documents in ESI held by third parties. Now, the obligation to notify the adversary about the evidence in the hands of third parties can be traced primarily to products liability litigation, in which defendant manufacturers were not able to inspect the product or otherwise assert defenses based on a plaintiff's misuse, alteration, or poor maintenance of the product. And then the practical ability standard, which requires the party to produce, search, collect, documents in ESI, and this is irrespective of that party's legal entitlement to the documents or their actual physical possession of the documents. So that practical ability is really the most draconian of the standards, and it's so amorphous, your obligations can sometimes be kind of hard to nail down. As I've stated, there's a jurisdictional conflict regarding this issue. In most cases, your agreement is going to call for the law that's going to apply, so you need to be aware of the state and local municipalities' rules on this. I've put together, and I'm not sure if you have the PowerPoint that I prepared, to go with this lecture. If not, then we can certainly distribute that. But the way that these standards have been applied varies significantly. The legal right standard is very popular with jurisdictions. Those jurisdictions that adhere to this standard are the 3rd, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 9th circuits. The 8th Circuit and 10th Circuit have both utilized the legal right standard. However, they have also stated the practical ability standard in some cases, and so it's hard to say which way the 8th or the 10th will go on this issue. And the 10th has actually also adopted the legal right plus notification standard. So the 10th is the only circuit in which I saw use of all three of these standards, but if you're in the 10th Circuit, which a lot of you may be, you really need to be aware of that conflict internally. And the 4th Circuit has applied the legal right plus notification, but has also employed practical ability. So the 4th Circuit is another one where you really need to be on your toes with regard to how the standard is going to be applied, because there's an internal conflict within the circuit. The legal right plus notification standard is utilized in the 1st Circuit, as I mentioned, in the 4th and 10th. And then the practical ability standard, which I think is the most complicated, most difficult, you see that in the 2nd, 4th, 8th, 10th, 11th, and D.C. So the way that this legal right standard is articulated varies, but you're usually going to see language in the cases that just make reference to this legal right to obtain the documents. It's fairly straightforward and easy to understand. Legal right plus notification, the cases will generally state that as follows, that the party owns and controls the documents, but to the extent that they've relinquished ownership or custody, they have to make sure to notify the other side where those documents are. And in the case of the 10th Circuit, they've stated that they must contact a new custodian, contact the new custodian, and let them know that they need to be preserving those documents. So that litigation hold issue becomes more complicated, because you may have an obligation to call whatever third party now has your documents or is in charge of your documents and make sure that they, too, are not inadvertently or advertently destroying anything. Practical ability, the way the courts address this is kind of all over the map. You may see the term practical ability, you may not. But most of the circuits do use that practical ability language. So your key considerations may seem obvious, but some that I'll throw out there for your consideration. I think I mentioned earlier third-party hosts of for example, a lot of people use an external company to manage their email or their cloud. So cloud computing becomes much more of a common practice nowadays. And so you need to also be cognizant of who's running those programs and what your company, by your company, of course, I mean your clients, what they're using in terms of a data management. Social media, as I said, that's something that you need to be aware of. Twitter, Facebook, a lot of companies use LinkedIn. Those are all areas where you're going to see some kind of duty to disclose, but whether or not it rises to the level of doing more than letting your opposing side know that there is a website or that they do make use of social media would have to be a jurisdictional question. You would have to look at how state and the state courts within your circuit have applied it. Personal v. work provided devices. Why is this relevant? Well, a lot of companies give their employees phones. Some law firms give their employees phones. And if those parties are using those work provided devices for email or work related texting, that too kind of falls within the purview of this rule, as do, and this is a little more difficult, is when you use your personal phone for work, and so you then have to wade into the area of what is your obligation with regard to an employee's private phone that they've been using extensively for business communications. That's something that comes up in case law, and the courts have found that you do have an obligation, even if it's your employee's personal phone, to obtain all those emails, texts, et cetera, to the extent relevant. And I'm sure there are mitigating circumstances, but again, that's going to be a case-by-case analysis, so something to be mindful of. This also applies to emails. So personal email used heavily for business opens the door for production of those. I saw one case, forgive me, I don't have the jurisdiction in front of me, but it was one of the practical ability cases in which an employer had placed several employees with one of its clients on a temporary basis so that they could work on site at the client's place of business and assist them with various tasks. While those employees were assigned to the client, they had email addresses through the client, not through their own company, and made use of those. In a litigation in which a motion to compel those emails was being heard, the court found that even though those emails were maintained by the client's company, not the employer that found itself party to the litigation, they still had an obligation to obtain and produce those documents and or coordinate with the third-party client to do so, which kind of surprised me. It's an extremely high standard. So, again, something to be aware of. Conflict of roles is going to become a huge issue as well. For example, and you know, you may have some kind of disclosure obligation that is hindered by a pre-existing agreement with third parties. So, for example, if you have confidential documents that were obtained during the course of litigation, for example, that you have an obligation not to produce, the court probably is still going to require you to do that. So you need to make sure that you're speaking with any third parties with whom you have those agreements, or you need to be making the other side aware of this so that you can come up with some way of addressing that, either with the court or informally. Again, laws of other jurisdictions might bar disclosure. Laws of the United States may bar disclosure. You may be running up against HIPAA, for example, or another law that prevents you from producing these documents. So something also to consider to get lined up when it comes time that you may need to address that with the court, that you know you are running into this conflict of requirements. This also comes up frequently in the international context. You'll see the laws of a particular country or jurisdiction within that country prevent disclosure of the particular documents that are being sought. And while it's perfectly acceptable to seek those within the United States, there is an affirmative duty not to disclose those in your other jurisdiction. And so that's something else you've really got to think about. So in conclusion, what do you need to do to kind of prepare yourself? Well, obviously know the applicable law and existing ethical standards within your jurisdiction. What does your contract say? You know, you may have some additional hoops to jump through based on whatever is required of you in the contract. Take a look at the case law on these issues. Please don't assume your jurisdiction is internally consistent. As we've seen, the Fourth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit in particular are not consistent on this, and so it's going to be even more difficult to parse what your responsibilities are within those jurisdictions. I think it's probably better to adhere on the practical ability standard because it is the highest, just in an abundance of caution. Do not borrow memos or rely on third parties. When I say borrow memos, a lot of times you'll have already looked at this issue in the context of another case. Because this is an ever-expanding area of the law and also one that each circuit seems to handle in a fairly unique manner, it's a good idea not to just rely on previous research. You'll want to start, I don't mean to imply you need to start from scratch, but you certainly need to run a search to see what may have changed in the intervening time. And obviously, if you're in a different jurisdiction, then you don't want to rely on that at all, and you'll want to look at that as a fresh matter. And when I say don't rely on third parties, you can't just trust that another party is going to maintain these documents. You do have an affirmative duty at a certain point to work with third parties and also to put them on notice, not to destroy things. So it's a very good idea to jump on that from the beginning and not run the risk that that's going to come back and later and become a problem. So just what are your steps? Develop a clear plan. Talk to your client. I put liquidated damages there, but in the chart. But I would just say, you know, consider what your possible damages await you under your agreement with the other side, and also within the jurisdiction if you violate any disclosure rules. And then reach out to third parties. Make sure that you have ownership over your own documentation, and that you're working from the get-go with the third parties in whatever form they may take in order to make sure that you do not find yourself on the wrong end of a motion to compel and for sanctions. With that, that's pretty much everything that I have on that. I'm happy to answer any questions that people may have. It is an incredibly complicated issue, and I can't stress highly enough how much homework is going to be required on everyone's part to make sure that you're complying. Obviously, try to err on the side of caution whenever possible, and be prepared for a lot of pushback from clients. I've already had some interesting conversations with clients about the heightened disclosure obligations and production responsibilities, which don't jive with what a lot of them are used to in state court. So with that, if you have any questions, please feel free to let me know. And thank you for your time.
Thanks, Laura. With that, I'm going to unmute everybody. We'll open it up to questions.
The conference is now in talk mode.
Okay, does anybody have any questions or comments for Laura based on her presentation? Okay. Well, Laura, I think you must have covered everything so thoroughly, or you know, scared us to death. Maybe I don't. One of the two.
I think a lot of people have their reaction to this.
So I guess your contact information is in the presentation slides that I think Hardy had distributed. So I'm sure if anybody has questions, they can reach out to you and let you know.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Parties, you've got a slide in here about parties having an agreement with a third party precluding disclosure. That's
right.
A fairly common thing to have.
Yep.
When you're using consultants, usually on technical issues, and they are prohibited. Well, their work is treated as our work product unless
right.
we make them a testifying expert. So how does that apply to those consulting agreements where they are required to keep everything confidential? We know they have it. We could ask them for it, so I guess it's readily available or within our control. But is that just part of the legal work product exemption?
Yeah, I think there's multiple kind of moving parts to that request that you just made, because I think the easy answer is yes, it is work product, and that is a protected communication. Where the lines become a little murkier are if they are compelled, then most non-disclosure agreements will contain some kind of caveat that if the party is requested to produce something in a legal proceeding, that they will notify you that they have been so compelled, and then typically the practice would be to go to the court to discuss, you know, what documents, if any, are being requested that are subject to those protections, and go from there. But in general, yes, that is work product. It's hard to know how this might arise. I'm assuming it would probably be within the context of the litigation for which you retained the expert, in which case the documents that you provided to them, to the extent that they were already discoverable, would need to be provided, but your correspondence with the consultant would not need to be. Obviously, this will be a case-by-case analysis. But I think you could certainly raise the fact that this agreement exists and that it would be protected by privilege. You would need to include it on a privilege log for sure.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Laura? All right. Well, with that, thank you again, Laura. Very and timely presentation, and we appreciate you doing that. With that, the meeting will be adjourned, and everybody next.
Thanks.